It is abundantly clear that God wants to be God in my life and in our lives, and in fact that He is God. And yet it's so ironic that it is the very abilities and skills and resourcefulness that He has given us that makes me think I am God of my own life, makes me think that I am in control of my own life.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, it looks like we're about in our third program of what it looks like to be a believer.
Yeah, we're talking about what the different aspects of the sanctification of the saints or the believers, and sanctification is the process whereby God changes us, transforms us, so that we look different and distinctive in this world. And we are in a section where we're talking about the sanctification of our mind, where God comes and makes me think differently, see the world differently.
Yeah, we're really trying to get at what does that change look like.
Right.
And we're looking at what does that change look like in terms of how we see God and how we see the world and other people and then how we see ourselves.
Right. Yeah. And we had got partway into the difference it makes in how we understand God when we ran out of time last time.
Okay. So before we get going, Jack, I'd like to request you listeners to respond to anything that you either like about what we're saying, or you have questions about, or maybe you're even angry about. We really welcome your letters or response to us so that we can be focusing in on what is unclear or what needs to be addressed more fully. Last week, Jack talked about a willingness to be teachable, a willingness to humbly be willing to look at and consider other options. And so we really want to ask you guys to go ahead. Give us a hard time. let us answer some of your questions.
Yeah.
So today we're going to continue with a growing understanding of God as part of what happens to in the life of a believer.
Yeah, so far we've talked about the fact that we grow in our understanding that God is good. And we talked a little bit about that. And then we got in a little bit into the fact that God is transcendent, and we talked about that. A closely related topic, I think, is our growing understanding that God is the only God. He's the one and only God. That's a theme that, of course, is very prominent in the Old Testament. What's called the Shema, which is a section, I believe, out of Deuteronomy that gets quoted in every synagogue service up to this day. At the beginning of the synagogue service, they quote, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one God." That theme is very, very prominent. But I think we have lost touch with exactly what that means, because we have lived in a Judeo-Christian culture now for millennia, and we're not immersed in the polytheism in which God was first trying to teach Israel that He was the only God. So I think we need to understand the background, or we won't really understand the significance of that and its relevance for our life, because I think it's very relevant for our lives today.
Yeah, when you say it, I think, well, most people think there's one God, at least in the culture that I've grown up in.
Right.
And so it really doesn't, I think, well, yeah, okay, I already know that. So what you're saying is it really does have more significance than what I'm thinking about, and maybe lots of our listeners.
Yeah, I think so. I think it probably does. To understand the background, I think we need to try to get some understanding of the logic and the the rationale of the polytheistic worldview. We look at polytheism, and it looks just like this really kind of bizarre, weird, cute little idea that somebody had back in the old days when people weren't as smart as we are.
Okay, stop. Polytheism is a word that means?
The belief that there are many gods. So, for example, in Greece and Rome, you had Zeus and Hera and Athena and Diana and Hermes. And there was the god of the ocean and the god of the sky and the god of love and the god of war. And these gods divided up life. And you worship them all and some of them, and some of them you worship more than others. And each individual kind of rolled their own religion as they decided to relate to the different gods that were there. In the Northern European Germanic culture, you had Thor, was the chief god in the Scandinavian hierarchy. In Babylon, which is more like the climate that the Old Testament was written in, Babylon and Egypt, you had Marduk, who was the main guy, the big god of Babylon. But there were just hundreds, thousands of other gods and goddesses that you had to pay attention to. And you'd
Jack,
offer them offerings.
How do you know all this? I listen to you kind of just, you know, be able to say what culture had what gods and even some of their names, and I don't even have a clue.
Well, I've just read a considerable amount about ancient religions and ancient philosophy, and that's just one of the areas that I've paid attention to.
Okay, so
I just read.
You read a lot. Okay. So I interrupted you and asked, you know, what is polytheism?
Yeah. So we have to understand the logic of polytheism, because, you know, to our way of thinking, it just seems so bizarre. I mean, you've got these people that commit adultery, or these gods and goddesses that commit adultery with one another, and they kill one another, and they have feuds with one another, and they get punished by all the other gods. They don't sound like gods. They sound just like people upstairs. They don't sound like gods. And they are described really just as people upstairs. What we have to understand, if we're going to understand it, is that
When you say people upstairs, you mean people that aren't living on the earth, but they're just people with the same kind of fallenness that we have,
right?
The same problems.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And they're all in war with each other, fighting with each other in interwoven, bickering back and forth, just like we do in our own families.
Right, right.
Okay.
Exactly. But the thing that we have to understand, if we're going to understand polytheism, is that it's a philosophically serious attempt to understand the world. And let me see if I can get that across and explain that. All of us are trying to understand our lives. We're trying to understand, why did that happen to me? Why did that tragedy happen? Why was my child killed? Or why was my wife killed? Why did I not get that job? Why did that other person get the job and I didn't? We look at the natural explanations in life. The other person got the job because they're better qualified. But then we look and we see, I don't have any natural explanations. I'm better qualified. I wanted it more. I needed it more.
It just looked right that I should get it.
It looks, from a natural point of view, it looked right that I should get it, but I didn't. What's happening? What's going on? What caused that other person to get the job?
Or why, if I had this great marriage and lots of children, did my wife die in a car accident?
Right. Exactly.
Why not somebody else who is abusing their family or has a terrible marriage? Why did that happen?
Right.
Lots of really important questions that all of us really have.
Right. And every human being has to come to terms with trying to understand their life, trying to understand those vexing questions that we face in life. Well, there's really basically philosophically two potential answers to that. One is that there's one ultimate explanation, which is the one that the Judeo-Christian tradition gives, the one that the Bible gives, the one that I talked about last week when I talked about God being the transcendent author of all things. He controls everything. He is the cause, the ultimate cause of everything that occurs. But the point being, he is one. He is singular. He is the only cause. That's one possible answer. The other possible answer is, oh, I get it. There's all kinds of forces and realities out there, back there, behind the scenes, all of which impinge on my life. And they impinge on my life, and they are colliding with one another, and in conflict with one another, in tension with one another, and who knows what the result of this collision of all these different forces and realities is going to be. But, and that's why my life seems so serendipitous on the one hand, and so inexplicable on the other hand, it's just so complicated out there. There are just so many things that you'd have to take into account that how can we ever know what the net result is going to be in my life? Add to that, now, then there's the question of, if there's all these realities out there that are somehow impinging on my life and affecting the course of my life, what's the nature of those realities and forces? Are they really in and of themselves predictable, like the forces in nature, gravity, what other forces in nature are there? Electricity. Do they follow natural laws, physical laws, or are they law-like in their functions, or are they not so law-like in their functions? The answer that the ancient people gave is they're really not so law-like in their functioning. They are more
law-like. They don't follow a particular pattern that you can count on every time.
Yeah, just regularly, routinely, and predictably. In other words, what the ancients were saying is they're more like people. You just never know how a person's going to respond. I mean, you know within limits. You get to know their character. You get to know their personality. But when I drop a book, I know it's going to drop to the ground. It just is. That's just the way gravity works. But when I say something nasty to a friend, one day I may get one response. The next day I may get a different response from them. And I learned that people are so complex that they're only predictable up to a point, and beyond that, they're really not very predictable. Certainly, they're not predictable with precision. So the ancient worldview was, there's this visible world that I live in, and then there's this upper story, this invisible world that I don't see, that is furnished with a multiplicity of different forces and different reality that are kind of people-like. They seem to all have a will of their own, and they are all vying for influence, vying for power, vying for dominion, fighting with each other, manipulating one another and whatnot. And what happens up there gets reflected in what happens in our lives down here.
Okay, so let me give this a shot. You've been saying a lot of stuff here.
Okay.
So in other words, the ancients thought that my life is really directed by what's going on in another world.
Right.
And what's happening in another world is there's all these gods that are kind of all fighting one another for probably preeminence. So perhaps when something bad happens in my life, the god of evil may be won out that day and the god of good lost. Mm-hmm. Or whatever god it was, say I was in a storm on the ocean in my sailboat, and the wind god won over the calm god, that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I just kind of don't know it. What doesn't have anything to do with me or my choices. It just kind of has to do with what happened up there, and that happened to affect my life at that particular time.
Yeah, except that with one qualification. Things are likely to go better for me if the gods, the various gods, are not displeased with me. That is, if they are displeased with me, maybe what happened is because the god of the wind was ticked with me and wanted to teach me a lesson or punish me in some way. So my life is going to go a whole lot better if I can keep as many of these gods and goddesses happy with me as I can.
So it really does have to do with my choices.
Right.
I keep on trying to make them happy with me, but there's a part that doesn't have to do with my choices, or the ancients believed, because even if the wind god is happy with me and the storm god isn't, well, they might fight and one will win over the other.
Yeah, I could just be a collateral casualty of something else that's going on. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very insecure worldview. I mean, a worldview that leaves me very insecure. There's just no telling. I'm the victim of all kinds of forces raging around me that I have very little control over.
Yeah, and also I'm thinking that in this polytheistic view that it gives me no freedom because I am really having to perform all the time for these gods.
Right.
I have to do it right. I have to figure out what they want. I'm continually doing that. And if things go wrong in my life, I can just think, man, I am really blowing it. So I imagine being under an incredible amount of tension all the time with this kind of a view.
Yeah. Very much like many Christians today. Let's just change the names. Instead of Zeus or Jupiter or Marduk, if we think in terms of the God of economics and the God of parenting and the God of marriage and the God of sexuality and the God of politics and the God of whatever, it's very easy to see how we are not too far from the same mindset at times, or at least can be, in the same mindset as the ancient polytheist. Because our attitude is, there are all these realities out there, and I know I have to understand them, I have to know how they work, I have to learn to get them to work in my favor. I need to do parenting right. I need to do marriage right. I need to do sexuality right. I need to do money right. I need to do politics right. And I have to control all these different forces by learning their inner nature and how to operate within their realm. If I don't, something in my life is going to fall apart on me. Something's not going to be successful. It's not going to go right. I would argue that is to think of my life that way, is to think of my life in exactly the same way the ancient polytheist was thinking of his life, exactly the way Israel was thinking of their life when God came along and said, cut it out. Don't look at life that way. There is one and only one God, and you only need to worry about one thing. The thing you need to worry about is me and how you're related to me and whether you are obeying me. Don't worry about those other realities because I take care of them. I'm the one who ultimately controls money and politics and marriage and family and parenting and so on.
Well, Jack, I would say it isn't some Christians, but it's also me, that I'm not thinking about, say, my concerns about finances as being a God that I'm worried about. But what you're saying is I might be displacing God's control of my life, love of me, mercy, his care of me, and having to really be anxious and worried about my finances. I'm not thinking that I'm worshiping another God. That's not the way I'm approaching it, as the ancients might.
Right. You don't take flowers and put it on an altar or...
No, I don't. And I don't even think that I'm worshiping another God. But what you're saying is, it is like worshiping another God when I am so overly concerned about any other issue in my life and not see God as the one who is, as we said last week, transcendent, who is the one that's taking care of me.
Right. And to say the same thing, to add to that, I think what I find myself doing is I take something like my finances and I basically move it out of God's domain over here into its own domain. I need God, I depend upon God to take care of my life, except I've got this one under control because I know how to do money. In effect, what I'm saying is, the reason I call it another God is because it's like it's its own autonomous reality. That's what the gods were to the ancient polytheist. They are just these realities, these forces that I have to come to terms with. Well, what if I already know how to come to terms with money, or at least think I do? If I already think that I know how to make money and take care of myself financially, then I don't need God to handle that. I don't need to concern him with that. and I don't need to relate that area of my life to God. And we take one or more of these areas of our life and we say, those are kind of controllable. Those are manageable. I don't really need God with respect to those. They can take care of themselves in the sense that I know how they work and I can do that.
Well, Jack, it seems like in my life, and I think in most people's lives, that's the process that we're in all the time, is kind of taking things out of God's domain and kind of getting control of them and having them all together, and then realizing, oh man, you know, I'm not trusting God in this area at all. And then working at having this be a part of what God's working with in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and then maybe I'm, you know, trusting God more with that area of my life, and then 5 years later I find out, wow, there it is back again. I have it all managed all by myself. So I'm continually in a process of giving it away, taking it back, and I think that God is in a process of showing me when I've taken things out of His hands, so to speak, or tried to do that.
Right. And so our sanctification is our growing understanding that everything that comes my way by the grace and the mercy of God, not by my cleverness, not by my knowledge and understanding of how these things work, but by the grace and the mercy of God. I mean, part of what it means to understand the role that God plays is to understand that I could do everything right economically and have my life be an economic disaster. And I could do everything right as a parent and have it all be a disaster in terms of the result, or look like a disaster to me and my marriage and every area of my life. There are no guarantees that if I just do it right, life is going to work out. Because what's going to happen is what God decrees, not what economics decrees, not what good parenting principles decree, but what God decrees. And what God could decree in my life is suffering and tragedy for His purposes, to accomplish His will, to accomplish my sanctification, teach me to know Him.
So people could be saying, Jack, okay, so I'll just throw up my hands and I won't try. If it's all up to God, if my choices don't really matter in terms of, say, example, how I parent, then I won't really even try. It seems like that's what your theology seems to be saying.
Okay. Well, if I could really say it doesn't really matter how I parent, then we're already lost. I mean, we're already way, way off track. Everything that I do in my life matters. That as a child of God, we'll talk about this more in the future, but as a child of God, I'm going to have a passion for righteousness. So to be a righteous parent, to do things right, should be a given for a child of God. Wanting to do things right will be a given. We don't do things right because we think there's going to be the payoff of parenting success. We do things right because it's right. We do things right because it's pleasing to God. We do things right because that's what obedience requires. It's a whole different kind of mindset.
Well, maybe this really shows my lack of spirituality, but I think I do things right partly because I just think it's right. But that's only come really quite recently that I do things right because it's right. Mostly I do things right because I don't want to get in trouble. Or more often I do things right because there's some good consequence. I want to be a good parent because I want my children to be healthy people, and I want them to love me, and I want them to have good lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that my choices will be, in part, have that consequence.
Yeah, of course, I'm not saying that there's anything incompatible about spirituality and a desire that there be prosperity of one kind or another, that my children prosper, that they're healthy, that they have good lives. I mean, what kind of monsters would we be as parents if we didn't want that for our children? That certainly wanting that and desiring that for them is appropriate. And doing things right in relationship to my children because it's right is, of course, compatible. And having the sort of hope and expectations that, generally speaking, if I treat my children right, the chances of them having a good life in the future is better than if I don't. That's a very commonsensical expectation, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that. Where we cross the line is when we get into the kind of desperate mode that I need to make careful that I dot every dot and cross every T in my parenting because I need to guarantee that my children prosper and have a good life.
Okay, now I think that's a very important distinction that I was kind of trying to funnel us down into, is it isn't that you're saying that that our choices don't matter and that we shouldn't try because God is in control of everything after all. You're saying there's this other principle too. We are, as believers, called to do what's right, called to do as best we can with the most wisdom we have, try to do what's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's a responsibility we have. And yet at the same time, as we're doing what's good or what we think is right, we ultimately don't have control of the consequences.
Right.
And no matter how well we do it, no matter if we dot every I and cross every T, there isn't a guarantee.
Right, exactly.
And if we think there's a guarantee, then we're making that our God.
Right. That's right. Exactly. We're trying to carve out a little part of my life where my fear is strong. We're trying to carve out a little part of my life and saying, God, I will handle this one. There's another reality out there. There's another God out there, or goddess, if you will, that I know how to honor that God or goddess, and they can take care of this area of my life. Would you please leave me alone there?
Or I might not even say that, Jack. I may not ever be conscious of saying, God, you just stay out of this part of my life.
Yeah, no, in all likelihood not, yeah.
Yeah, and I think of an example in my life. I do a lot of marriage counseling. And so, you know, I know a lot about marriage. I know a lot about how to do it well. You know how crummy I am as a wife sometimes? You know? And it really brings me up very short and makes me know there isn't a lot that I can do. I mean, I can really try and do it right as I know, and yet I am a constant failure. And out of that failure, I really have to go to what you're saying here, is to understand God's mercy toward me. And yet there's a lot of areas of life, say finances, that I am not good in this one either, but some people are, and they do it really well, and they're very successful. Maybe because they have a lot of money, or they just have a lot of security in whatever situation they're in financially. Maybe they have managed their money well, or they're not in debt, or they've finally been able to buy a home after years of saving, or whatever financial management strategy they have. And they've done it really well, and it isn't apparent to them that they're a failure here. And that's where it's more scary, is we don't... when we get something down so well that we think we've got control of it, because it's all turned out well. For whatever reason, God has decided not to make that a hard area in our life.
Right. Yeah, we take what basically are blessings from God, and we, in our arrogance, we say we did it. It's my knowledge, it's my understanding, it's my responsibility, it's my virtue that has attained this and has secured this for myself, rather than saying, you know, it really didn't have to go this way. As much as I have worked hard and saved and been responsible, there could have been any number of disasters along the way that could have created a financial setback that would have devastated us. And it's by the grace of God that those didn't happen. So,
I think
we lose sight of that, though.
We do, because I want to feel good about me.
Mm-hmm.
When I have done something well, I really want to think, oh, gosh, Christine, you do pretty well. You know, there's just mm-hmm. that sense that we all have that just wants to feel good about ourselves by what we've done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's our blinder.
Exactly. And to put it in the bigger picture here, what the larger picture we're talking about is coming to a growing understanding of God and who God is. The more we understand who God is, the more we shrink in comparison. And yet that's at the heart of our blindness, our evil, our foolishness, is that we really think that we're not quite as big as God, but we're getting there. You know, we're right up there. we're pretty close to his peers. That's how we would like to think of ourselves. And it's not even close. We are utterly and completely and totally at his mercy. We are his creatures.
I was just reading a poem. I can't remember who wrote it, but and I can't quote it very well. I'll quote it like you quote scripture.
Okay.
Poorly.
Somewhere it said something like...
Yeah. It was a poem about written by a man who said, "When I was young, I was tall like the trees. But after a time, 30 years later now, I have become like one among the grasses." So as I grow in age, actually that's what you're talking about. My vision of myself becomes smaller among the grasses instead of a tree,
yeah,
in understanding myself in relationship to God.
Yeah.
Now, was that about as clear as fog?
No, that was very clear. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There's the psalm where David, you know, likens himself to a child at his mother's breast. You know, he's come to a point of realizing he doesn't understand anything. All he knows is that he needs God. He is completely dependent upon God. And that's maturity. That's coming to see things the way they really are. That God is so big and I am so small by comparison, that every detail, every aspect of every detail of my life is completely and totally controlled by God. And it's only by his grace that my efforts in any way pay off to me and result in a success in my life. It didn't have to go that way. God could have decreed otherwise.
It's a real paradox, isn't it? That we come to see ourselves as small rather than as competent and big as believers.
Yeah, yeah. Notice the difference in the end when we do come to see that. Unlike the polytheist, who could also see himself as small in this world of large, raging, out-of-control forces that are whirling around him, we see ourselves small in comparison to one and only one author of all things, who, as we saw in a prior session, is good, not the least bit evil. There's not a shade of evil in him, and who loves me. I mean, the security that, if I really get the picture rightly, the security that offers, as opposed to the insecurity of the polytheistic worldview, I'm not just straw being blown around by hurricane force winds. I am small and utterly dependent, but I am loved and focused on and concerned of the one and only one that matters, the God who's there, who is the only one that really counts.
And that's, sometimes we just have to know that in our minds. Maybe very often we just have to know that God is good and that God loves me in my mind, because it can appear as though, and that God is in control, because it can appear as though my life is just in a hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm being tossed and turned, and nothing, it looks like there's a bunch of gods up there fighting each other, and that it's all out of control. My big picture of that is the Holocaust. The Holocaust does not look like an in-control, loving, and good God to me.
Right.
And so when I come to that, I have such a difficult emotional response to that, that I just have to say, I am deciding to trust God, who I do not understand. I don't get why he did it this way. I wouldn't have done it that way.
Right. No, that's right. And I think we've talked about that a little bit previously, that in the book of Job, where Job comes to exactly that position, is, okay, I see, I'm not going to understand how it is that your goodness is translating into this suffering and sorrow that I'm seeing here, but then there's a lot about you I don't understand because you're so big. I guess the only important thing is that you understand what you're doing, not that I understand what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where we have to land, is that, God, you've demonstrated your wisdom. You've demonstrated that you know how to put a world together. You've demonstrated that you understand the intricacies of everything that you've made. And I guess I can trust you to understand that if you decree sorrow, you have a reason for it, and it's a good reason. But I can't see it.
So a lot of people at this point would be saying, wait a minute, Jack, God does not decree suffering. Yes, I'll agree with you that there's one God. I'll agree with you that He really ultimately needs to be in control of my life, and I need to not make other gods in the way that we've been talking about them. I need to understand that God is in control of all of my life. But I won't go along with you that God would ordain suffering or difficulty or awful things in my life. He has allowed the God of this world, Satan, to come in and have some power here.
Okay. A couple things I can say in response to that. First of all, logically, if the God of this world really is a God of this world, then we don't believe what we say we believe. And that is, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one God. That there really is only one God who deserves to be called a God. There's really only one God whose will is a force to be reckoned with. If it's God against Satan, even if God is bigger and tougher than Satan, if Satan's will is not the creation of God, ultimately, is not actually determined and dictated by the will of God itself, then Satan is a force to be reckoned with. And there is not one God, but two gods. That's not what we believe.
But wouldn't people say that God has given Satan the power in this world? He has given it over to Satan.
Yeah, the issue is not whether God has given power to things. I mean, He's given you power. He's given me power. He's given the ocean power. He's given the winds power. The issue, though, is whether that power is autonomous. And what I mean by that is, you know, does God give it power within itself that at its own discretion or according to its own nature and principles, it just buzzes along doing its own thing outside of God's ongoing control? If so, then it has its power autonomously in and of itself. And that's where I think we have misconstrued what the Bible is saying. The Bible is not saying that God has ever created power for His creatures to operate autonomously. Nothing is autonomous of God, from God.
Autonomous, nothing is running on its own.
Yeah, nothing is just sort of buzzing along, chugging along, doing its own thing at its own discretion according to its own nature and principles. Everything does exactly as God wills, exactly as God decrees. See, otherwise Jesus couldn't say what He did when He said, not a sparrow falls to the ground, but your Father knows it, I think is how He put it. The very span of our life is measured by God, and we can't, my worry and my concern can't add a cubit to my lifespan. That, those kinds of things. If all of this stuff is just operating autonomously, then it's ultimately no longer under God's control. He created it all. He made it all possible, but it's not really controlled by Him. But if it's not controlled by Him, if we really believe that, then there's all kinds of things that God cannot do and cannot accomplish. Satan is a creature. His will is not autonomous from the will of God. Ultimately, Satan can, even when he seeks to do his evil purposes in rebellion against God, he can only ultimately be a pawn in God's game. He can only ultimately accomplish exactly as God has willed him to accomplish and do exactly as God has willed. That's the biblical perspective. The other perspective is some kind of homespun folk religion that we believe in. That's a step back toward polytheism. And that's not the biblical perspective. Now, I will say, my other comment is, I will say, it's taken me quite a few years now of wrestling with these issues to come to these conclusions, because I was much more comfortable in the early years of my Christian life thinking in terms of us and Satan and angels and everything else in the world being autonomous. And chugging along and buzzing along on their own, and that was my worldview. But the more I studied the scriptures and the more I came to terms with this concept that God is the one and only God that exists, I began to see the implications of that. And then I saw passage after passage that supported me in understanding that this is the right track. This is what the Bible is saying. God says in Isaiah, it talks about God who creates light and creates darkness, who creates good and who creates evil. Well, that's exactly what you would expect if God is really the one and only true God, the one and only one who deserves to be called a God.
Does Isaiah say it that directly, or are you just misquoting?
No, he says it that directly.
I don't mean misquoting in terms of trying to misquote, but just kind of a paraphrase.
Right. No, that's what he says. And it's the Hebrew word for evil is ra'ah. It can be used in a lot of, it's sort of like bad, our word bad. You can use it a lot of different ways in a lot of different contexts. And so there are many Bible teachers who'd say, well, he can't mean evil there. He just means bad things like famine and drought and the stuff that we will acknowledge that God has control over. But he's not responsible for the evil choices of people and that sort of thing. But as I look at it, I don't think that's what Isaiah means. I think Isaiah means that absolutely. God is so majestic, so transcendent, that he is the one who is the author of light and darkness, of good and evil. Everything that is in this world is ultimately comes from the only source of anything, God.
So the scream that you always get in response to this must be, then, Jack, are we merely puppets on a string? Are we just people who don't really have free choice, our choices don't really mean anything, and God is just deciding for us?
Well, if we mean by that, Jack, are we merely creatures? Then my answer is yes. Yes, we're merely creatures. If God didn't will my existence, I'd pop out of existence the next second. I'm that fragile. I'm that vulnerable. I'm that dependent. I am that contingent. Nothing about me requires that my existence sustain itself. I'm here solely by the will of God because he creates me. So if that's what we mean by puppet, then yeah, that's what we are. But if I mean that God is sort of coercing me into my actions and they don't really reflect me because I didn't really want to do that evil, it's that God was manipulating me into doing that evil, then the answer to that is no, that's not the picture. That what God is creating are free will agents. I have free will. I do what I want to do. I do freely the evil that I choose and do freely the good that I choose when I choose good. And therefore, the choices that I make are reflective of my character, of my person, of my personality, and so on, because my actions freely flow out of who it is that God has made me to be. Well, that's not a puppet. You know, a puppet has
strings attached
that are coercing my arms and legs and tongue and mouth and whatever to do what it does. God is not pulling my strings. He's creating me, and that's entirely different. A better analogy than the puppet would be the character in a novel, say. If I'm the character in a novel, then God is my author. And every word that comes out of my mouth is ultimately decreed by God, the author. I can't speak on my own. But the author of my being is creating me, this character in this reality. And as he creates me, he creates me to be a certain kind of person who freely does what I choose.
You know, I'm realizing that we're coming to the end of our hour here, and there's this real difficult obstacle for our brains to try to comprehend, how in the world is God creating me to be a free agent, to give me free will, and at the same time, he's the one that designs everything. That is what you're saying, And that is a tough one to get.
Yeah, it is. It's taken me years to come to terms with it. It's very difficult.
So I don't think we have time to talk about that right now, because we need to go back and look at what we've said today and try to see if we can make any, give an overview of what we've said today. But we must come back to that again.
Okay.
Do you get these questions all the time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So let's go back and try and summarize what we've said today.
Well, the main point that we were trying to explore is the fact that God is the one and only being, the one and only person, the one and only reality that we have to come to terms with. The only thing I should really worry about in life is, am I obeying God? Am I rightly related to God? Am I living my life in a way that is pleasing to God? That's the only thing really ultimately that counts. Because no other force, no other reality out there can bring me any blessings if God does not will it. And I likened it in modern times, it's not ancient gods that we're worried about. It's things like economics and parenting and marriage, and we have principles for this and principles for that and principles for this. And we can get into a mindset where we think that by simply managing, living according to the right principles, I can take an area of life, wrest it out of God's control into my own control, and make it work for me and make my life successful. But the reality is, I'm only going to be blessed by the blessings that God sends me. There are no guarantees that I can ever make my life work for me on my own. And with that, out of that perspective, out of that understanding, then I need to turn to God and deal with Him and Him alone and say, God, have mercy on me. God, I need your blessings. So, normally they will be there. Normally He will bless me. Sometimes He will not bless me. Sometimes He will bring sorrow and suffering and tragedy into my life. And then I have to come to terms with knowing the God who even brought tragedy into my life and deciding what I'm going to do about that. What am I going to think about that? Just as Job did in the Old Testament.
And I'm thinking that the reason it's so hard to do that, it's so hard to depend on God and to make God God, is because God made me, He made us to be strong in lots of ways.
Creative, resourceful.
Capable.
Capable.
And able to become more capable as we grow. Better. I'm a better parent today than I was 15, 20 years ago. But so it really is kind of a difficulty for us to understand the place of God in our lives because of the capabilities, the very capabilities that He has given us.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So, you're thinking of sending your kid to college, or do you want to attend yourself? Before making your decision, be sure to ask this question. What is college for? For some, college is the rite of passage from youth to adulthood. For others, it's a stepping stone to a good job. Gutenberg College believes education should be a doorway to a good life. Then you might wisely ask, what is a good life? The Gutenberg College faculty and staff are committed to the conviction that living the good life is rooted in wisdom and character. Admittedly, Gutenberg is not for everyone. But if you are interested in reading and discussing the greatest thinkers, philosophers, poets, and theologians of Western civilization, if you are interested in working personally with your teachers, if you want to open the doorway to a good life, there is not a better education opportunity offered in the Northwest than Gutenberg College. Most members of the Gutenberg faculty also teach at McKenzie Study Center. McKenzie was founded on the belief that a clear understanding of God's Word is more than an intellectual exercise. that the Bible has a radical message for every human being. At McKenzie, you can find classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. At the conclusion of today's program, I'll tell you how you can contact McKenzie Study Center and Wittenberg College. But now, let's get back to Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber for the conclusion of today's program.
We've been asked to make an appeal for financial support at the end of each one of our shows. And when I think about making an appeal for financial support, I think about all you guys giving and to many, perhaps many ministries, perhaps to your church, perhaps to other radio stations, other ministries, other missions. And although we're not asking you in any way to pull back support from any of those ministries, we do also have a need here on our program. I know when I'm asked for money, I get kind of this anxious, kind of frantic feeling, because it seems like money is really hard to get. Doesn't seem like, it is really hard to get, and that there's lots and lots of places where it needs to go. As winter's coming on, I just made a trip to a store to buy coats and shoes and vests and socks and all sorts of cold weather gear for my children who are going back to school and going to be riding their bikes to school. And it just took a whole bunch of money. So I know from a very practical standpoint that not having a lot of money or having a lot of places where your money can go is a real concern for people. However, we also have the need here. Jack, in helping people think about how to give, could you talk to us a little bit about a motive behind giving to any particular ministry?
I think there's really two things that go into what the New Testament teaches about giving. One is that what we give to is, to a certain extent, a reflection of where my heart is. Am I investing in this world and the stuff of this world, or am I investing in truth and the gospel and God's ultimate eternal purposes in the world? And that, it seems to me, is a really valid motive for giving, is that I recognize that through my gift, I can advance the propagation of the truth, the proclamation of the truth that is the most important and precious truth that there is. And if that's what is motivating me, is I want to be a patron, I want to be a supporter, I want to be someone who finances the proclamation of the gospel, then I think that's a very good and right motive. Guilt is not a particularly good motive. Shame is not a good motive. Ambition is not a good motive. There's a lot of evil motives that can go into our giving to ministry. But the one that it seems to me the most important and most pronounced in the New Testament is, I'm giving because I love God and what He's doing in the world, and I want to be a part of it.
And I think particularly for this show, if I want to be a part of promoting what we're communicating about the faith in this show, if I want to give for that.
Right, exactly.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.